for your life. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. And we're pleased to have back with us on the program once again, May Barenbaum. She is an entomologist. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. She is, in fact, the head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And occasionally she is here to help us out and spend some time talking about insects. Whenever she is here, I always try to make very clear at the beginning of the program is that she does not specialize in extermination. We have a guy for that, Phil Nixon, who actually we also want to say that Phil loves bugs just as much as May does. And I think he's a kill only as last resort guy. He's one of those people that got interested in entomology, I think, because he thought bugs were really cool. So I want to make really clear that Phil loves the bugs, too. But when Phil is on the show, that we do extermination stuff. When May is here, it's a different kind of a program. And lo, these many years ago, when she first started coming over to the show, we just thought it would be fun to have her here just to talk about insects, to answer questions, and to try to appreciate them for all of the many and varied ways they go about living their lives and all of the many incredible shapes and sizes and designs that they come with. So that's what we do here. If you have insect questions, those kinds of questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Maybe you have seen something and you're wondering what it is, you weren't quite sure. If you can give us a description the best you can, she may be able to tell you what it is. Obviously, that's difficult because she can't see what it is you're talking about. But there are sometimes, sometimes the insects have features that are just dead giveaway. And as soon as she hears that, she says, oh, okay, I think I can tell you what that is. So we can do that. And whatever other questions you might have about insects, you are certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
For being here. I was just thinking I might have you talk a little bit about cicada, just because they're definitely there. They're singing their little hearts out. I was thinking about this yesterday because the weather got nice enough, so for the first time in some time in our house, we turned off the air conditioning and we opened up the house. And we were sitting there yesterday, late afternoon or early evening, whatever it was, and they were going at it great guns. And I guess I was among the things I was wondering about was adult cicadas and what it is they do. And is their main function just to reproduce?
Well, actually, yeah, I suppose that's a fair enough statement. They can feed. They don't do massive damage by feeding. They're in a group called the true bugs. They have, that's a group that entomologists define as having sucking mouth parts. So they have these piercing sucking mouth parts they can use to poke holes and suck plant sap. But most of their time is spent either finding a mate, mating, or in the case of females, laying eggs. Damage that cicadas do is usually associated with the fact that females have a saw-like ovipositor or egg-laying device that make little slits in sort of young twigs and branches. And it's usually that's only a problem for the periodical cicadas, which come out in enormous numbers every 13 or 17 years. The ones we are hearing now, appropriately enough, are often called the dog day cicadas or the harvest flies. They're not, of course, flies, but that's, you know, everything with wings is at one time or another called a fly. And they come out this time of year. They're a lot more drab than the periodical cicadas. They're sort of greenish-brownish. There's a number of species. They have also a lot more traditional in their life cycle. It's 1 or 2 years underground sucking the sap and roots rather than 13 years or 17 years. So that's what's out there now. And one of the another thing you might see this time of year, and I've gotten some calls about the cicada killers, the largest wasp east of the Rockies is a kind of wasp that specializes on cicadas, as the name suggests. The females will seek out a cicada, grab it, and then sting it and use its venom to paralyze the cicada while this wasp – I mean, they're big wasps, but cicadas are pretty hefty creatures. So you'll see – if you ever see a wasp flying relatively low to the ground, like it's got a it's carrying a heavy load. It is carrying a heavy load. I don't even know how they get airborne. In fact, they kind of will sort of launch themselves in kind of a descending trajectory to get to a – they like to dig nests in sandy places. And they'll dig a little tunnel, put the paralyzed cicada down next to an egg, and the hatching grub will slowly consume the paralyzed cicada in what must be a horrific way to die if you're an insect. Although I guess there's – not that many pleasant ways that insects die, I suppose. Mm. I don't know. Nobody's really looked into that. We don't know the insect perspective on that. But anyway, so that's a common sight and a common sound. If you ever hear, you know, that classic cicada trill, which I won't reproduce here. It's not part of my repertoire here. But if you ever hear it sort of stop in mid-trill, that's what's happening. There's a cicada male who, you know, only the males sing, who got... a surprise, I guess. And his performance was abruptly interrupted. So.
Well, one of the, I guess in my thinking about this and sitting there talking at dinner with Mrs. Inge, I guess the one of the things that I started thinking about was as far as adult insects are concerned, is in fact in the adult form, their basic function is to reproduce?
Well, that's one of the secrets to, I don't know if it's a secret, but one of the... underlying features of insect life that makes them so successful is specialization. You know, the immature stages, for the most part, focus on growing and eating. And that's one reason caterpillars, for example, can increase in size from 4,000 to 10,000-fold in 2 weeks. Can you imagine if a 7-pound baby increased 10,000-fold in a couple of weeks? You know, imagine what the formula and diaper bills would be. It'd be kind of... terrifying, but that they are specialized for eating and growing, and then the adult stages are specialized for two things, reproducing and for dispersing, for moving away from where they were born. That's you never see wings on an immature insect. They don't need them. They don't have to go anywhere. They're just there to eat. That's their job. That's what they do. So specialization is key. They, you know, we humans stumbled on this idea eons after the insects developed it. So.
Hmm. Well, one more question, and then we'll get to the phones here, because I'm prompted here to ask this question, because sometimes we, in a casual sort of a way, refer to these insects, cicada, as locust.
Uh-huh.
But the locust is something else, right?
Right. That's one of the problems with common names is that they're not particularly they're not used with care. A locust, properly speaking, at least as an entomologist speaks, is a migratory grasshopper that periodically erupts into large numbers. The concept of this of locust meaning, you know, many
as in a plague,
yeah,
of?
As a plague of, it goes right back to the Bible. So when Europeans arrived here and encountered their first outbreak of cicadas, where if you've ever seen a periodical cicada outbreak, I mean, they're everywhere. The din is so loud. It's sort of on the order of an airport landing field is how loud it is. You often see that description. I wonder what in the 17th century they compared it to. It's like... there weren't any, like, airports that they could compare the noise to, as loud as a stampede of bison. I don't know. But they had no idea what the insects were. They didn't count leg segments. They didn't look at mouth parts. They said, whoa, there's a lot of these things around. We're experiencing a plague. And that's how they became known as locusts. But they're not locusts. In fact, there's even a rap song where that point is made. I don't know if I should... repeat the...
Is it something we can say on the radio?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is not a very well-known, not by anybody. It's basically, let's see, something the effect of... they come out of the ground, their eyes don't focus. Some folks call them 17-year locusts, but that's the wrong data. Their name is cicada. They may be here now, but they won't be here later. Check it out.
Forgive me, but I can't help believing that that was made up by some entomologist.
No, actually, it was... I can't remember the name of the rapper, but it's about... 15 years old now, but it's a genuine, it was not an entomologist.
Oh, okay. I'll believe you. if you say so. May Barenbaum is here.
There's drug references in the later verses.
Oh, so. I see. Okay, so we don't want to. she's an entomologist. She studies insects. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I and occasionally is here, and we talk about insects. Appreciate them. And we say save the extermination questions for another day. But general sorts of bug questions, she'll do her best. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll start with someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. I've also been wondering about cicadas, so I was happy to hear the subject of the show, and I have cicada questions that I've had nobody to ask, and I'm very happy to do that. What I wanted to know is, they get really loud at our house. How many are there? I mean, in the trees around, like, is it thick with them, or does it not take too many to make so much noise?
It's tough to answer that. It doesn't take that many, actually, to make that much noise. And the dog day or harvest fly, the dog day cicada, the one you're hearing now, uh-huh. doesn't reproduce to nearly the extent, or at least doesn't emerge in synchrony to the extent that the periodical cicadas do. I can't really give you a number because it would be really hard even to judge if you were out there with a microphone and a recording device. One thing about insect sound makers in general is they are extraordinarily good at increasing the volume and making it difficult to localize the sound, sort of a ventriloquial effect. Nobody sees lips moving. You can't really tell where the sound is coming from. And that's really important for them because we humans often find it difficult to sort of zero in. It's hard to tell where a cricket, for example, is.
Right.
You can hear the sound, but we're not particularly good at localizing sounds. Other animals have better auditory equipment than we do, including, for example, cicada killers whose life depends on it.
Uh-huh.
But that's one reason it's hard to judge how many of them are out there and where they are because of that.
My other question is, because I was expecting in these different seasons that we've lived here and we've experienced this, that at the end of the season you would see a lot of dead ones. Like, how come we don't see very many dead ones, yet we've heard so many of them at the peak of the season?
Well, if you talk to the folks who were out in the East Coast during the Brood 10 emergence, they'll tell you about dead cicadas. They were ankle deep in dead cicadas. And one reason that the periodical cicadas leave so much debris, or I guess whatever the term would be, is that they are so numerous that they exceed the capacity of nature to clean up its messes.
Uh-huh.
So here we don't have vast numbers, and a hunk of cicada body is a nutrient-packed, delicious morsel for most organisms other than us humans who would probably look askance.
I think my cat's eating that.
No, there you go. Uh-huh. So with reasonable numbers, the carcasses get snarfed up, but when you end up exceeding the capacity of the so-called detritivores, bottom feeders, I guess, the guys at the bottom of the food chain that eat dead stuff, then you'll see accumulating carcasses all over the place. They would tend to fall in wooded areas, and they tend to be fairly camouflaged. They're sort of brown and green, so I guess if a cicada falls in the forest, does anyone hear it?
I don't know. We have the trees in our yard, and they are so loud. I thought, okay, when the season is over, we'll see how many there were because we'll see some of these, the shells of them or something, but you don't really see it.
Yeah, well, check your cat and anybody else who's possums, I'm sure,
squirrels,
are gobbling these up.
Now?
Squirrels are funny. Most people think squirrels are these, you know, adorable little nut-nibbling creatures, but they will on occasion turn carnivore, so wouldn't surprise me if there were some squirrels out there burying some cicadas for the winter or something. So.
Okay, well, thanks.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go next to a caller in Indiana, someone near Indianapolis on our line four here. Hello.
My turn?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In early June, on concrete surfaces, on the apron leading up to the hay wagon door of the barn, for example, I observed very small red creatures I don't know their length, but a tenth of a millimeter, perhaps as little as a hundredth of a millimeter. To capture some for study, I used pressure-sensitive tape, and that rather damaged them so badly that under the microscope I couldn't tell very well what I had. Do you know enough already, or shall I tell you more?
Well, more would help. I have an idea, but it's fairly ill-formed, so...
Well, these were... They appeared to have thin, flat bodies, more or less what I might call almond-shaped, and they had legs, and I wasn't sure because picking them up on pressure-sensitive tape, I damaged all that I caught, and I was not able to get a very good view. But I think they had eight legs on each creature. I saw no separate body segment, no head, no thorax. And I studied the legs, and I was not able for sure to make out, but I think each leg may have had five segments, and they moved independently, of course. Shall I tell you more?
Well, actually, that is a superb description. I'm very impressed. Usually, what people will say is, there's little tiny red things, and I don't know, they maybe had legs. So that you could count eight, you basically nailed it right there. And the fact that you didn't see the traditional three body region divisions, when you first described it, red is kind of, it's not that common a color. Most organisms don't like to advertise their presence, and red is something that a lot of predatory creatures can see. But so red narrows it down, and one group of organisms which have a lot of red representatives are the mites, little tiny spider mites, and or mites in general. And the fact that you counted eight legs confirms the fact that, well, at least is consistent with the interpretation that you what you're seeing were mites, maybe clover mites. These are little tiny mites that tend to come out in early spring. They feed on foliage and end up blowing into people's windows and the like, so that they were near your hay barn is not out of the realm of possibility. Mites are not insects. They are arachnids, though they're related to spiders and ticks. They're actually more closely related to ticks. They're acarines like ticks, that where spiders, unlike insects, have two major body regions, so a sort of a combo head-thorax arrangement called a cephalothorax and an abdomen. But in mites, the dimensions aren't that different, so it looks like there's just one sort of uniform, like you say, almond-shaped body. And another characteristic that mites share with spiders is that many species are capable of spinning silk, and that the most famous probably the most notorious mite around here is the two-spotted spider mite. And spider mites are called spider mites because they envelop the plants they feed on in a spider web. It's not a spider web, it's a spider mite web. But exactly which species of mite you have, that's a tough call because, frankly, when they get that small, they all kind of at least look the same to me. And I'm an entomologist, not an acarologist. So clover mite would be one guess because they do come out springtime. They feed on all kinds of things, weeds and grasses and herbaceous plants. Then they also sometimes feed on woody plants like trees and the like. So they're most active in the spring. They're also active in the fall. I don't know if you've seen them again yet.
I haven't yet.
Okay. And they are associated with buildings. They lay eggs in or around buildings. And let's see. Sometimes you get a second generation in the fall. But probably that would be my guess, the spider mite. A clover mite. But then might be something else.
You say that they are young chiggers.
Actually, young chiggers are mites, but that's a different species. And they are. They're a young species. They're the young stage of a different mite, a harvest mite. But I wouldn't expect to see the chiggers are parasites and tend not to aggregate, you know, in large numbers off a host. And their behavior, the young stages are the ones that are parasitic, and chiggers will climb up on vegetation and engage in a behavior called questing, which is basically sitting at the tip and waving their legs around, hoping to blunder into something passing by.
And they climb up on me.
Yeah, well, that's your a meal of choice, although many chiggers actually prefer cold-blooded vertebrates like snakes. And as I said on this program before, my heart goes out to those snakes since they have no appendages with which to scratch. So if you've ever had chiggers, you know it's an unbelievably itchy infestation. So, but what to me, the proximity to the building and the large number is suggestive of one of the plant feeding mites like the clover mite.
And the size is consistent?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, mites are small. that's the range within mites is from really, really small to pretty small, basically. You described it as what? What was the dimension that you...
Under a microscope, I have a good microscope, from maybe a tenth of a millimeter to as small as a hundredth. I couldn't be sure.
Yeah, well, that would be consistent with a lot of mites. And the trouble, too, is that mites will go through several developmental stages as well. So they can start out really, really small and then at maturity be only really small. So it's... a mite, yeah, it's actually a word that's entered our vocabulary. So a mite hungry, I'm a little hungry. So that's where that comes from. It means little. And they are.
The term also is used to mean small, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. I am continually impressed by your ability to do this and also with the scientific precision with which you describe things, including terms like really, really small and really small. That's the reason we have you on this show.
Oh, yeah. That's...
May Barenbaum.
Give your reference on that, too.
Okay. She is the head of the Department of Entomology, and aren't they proud? She is here occasionally. We talk about insects, and we always have fun when she is here. By the way, if you're interested, she has authored a number of books, and some of that you might look for include her book, Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs, a collection of writings that she's done that's called Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. And then, of course, the two immortals, 99... what the heck is that book? 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, and the other one is 99 More Maggots, Mites, and Munchers, and they're both published by the U of I Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone next up in Iroquois County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I encountered a large insect this summer that I had never seen before. It was in our grass. At first I thought, it was but anyway, I saw a bug collection at our county fair and they had it labeled as a megaloptera or something like that.
Megaloptera?
Yeah. It had huge pinchers on it. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure thing.
I've never seen one before.
They are. Well, you may have, if you're a fisherman, you may have seen the immature stage. If you ever heard of a helgramite?
No, I'm not familiar with it at all.
This is the common name of the megaloptera, and I guess that was in a collection. I don't think they were just trying to impress people. Is a Dobson fly, and Dobson flies are in a group called the Neuroptera or nerve winged insects, and they're called nerve wing insects because they have wings with all kinds of little veins all across the More, they're actually fairly primitive as insects go with complete development. So there are two groups of insects, insects that look the same when they're little and when they're big except for the wings, and other insects that undergo a complete metamorphosis or transformation. So caterpillars don't look like butterflies. Similarly, Dobson flies, when they're little, are aquatic. They live in lakes and or streams and rivers and the like. And... their immature stages are called helgramites. They, look like little sea monsters, actually. They have pretty impressive jaws when they're little, too. They're voracious carnivores in immature stages. And they'll bite people, too, if you mishandle them. The adults have those really impressive mandibles, pinchers, as you say, at the front end. Males more than females. And actually, they look scary, but they're not, unless you happen to be a female who's uninterested in a particular male, because they're used, those giant pincher-like mouth parts are used mostly for mating and courtship, and that don't really pose a threat to people. So the Dobson flies are huge. They can be over 5 inches long. I don't know if that's how big the one you saw.
It was 3 or 4 inches long.
Yeah.
Like, wow, what is this?
And yeah, and the mandibles are half the length of the body.
Right.
So you get these 2.5-inch long mandibles projecting outward. Looks like something you'd want to stay away from. But mostly they're used for impressing females. So I guess they impressed you, but for the wrong reasons. So.
What do they feed on?
I'm not sure the adults eat at all. They don't really live very long. They do most of their feeding as voracious carnivores in the immature stages. Mostly, like David said, we started the show talking about how they concentrate. They're specialized. So the adult stages of Dobson flies mostly are interested in flying around and mating and reproducing.
Well, we don't live close to any lakes or streams, so maybe that's why I've never seen one before.
Yeah. So you saw it in your yard?
Or
you
We live out in the country, so it's so dry and stuff. It made me think, oh Lord, we're having a plague of locusts here.
It's odd though because the adults don't usually travel that far from water, so. Hard to say what was going through that guy's mind when he showed up in your yard. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go talk next with someone else in Indiana. Indiana here, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Got those $2.99 books. They're interesting. That's for sure.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Three things. One, the cicada, when it climbs up on the tree, or as one did a few days ago on my railing for my porch. And that split, I was wondering about the mechanism of that. As a youngster, I remember adults telling me that they get so large they just split their body. And that seemed reasonable at the time, but now that I'm a little older, it doesn't seem that reasonable. Second thing is, what's the situation with the honeybees now? Has there been any improvement in their populations, or are they still dwindling? And the third question deals with mites. What do they eat when they're on their prey? I've seen some photographs, of an insect it was almost hard to see the insect. And I was wondering if they have the mouth parts to suck out juices or exactly what they're doing on there. And thanks a lot.
Sure. So there's three questions. The first question is about cicadas and molting. The person who told you that they split their bodies wasn't exactly accurate. What they're doing is just splitting their skin. Their external skeleton. So all insects, all arthropods actually have this external skeleton. We have our skeleton on the inside. They have one on the outside. And it's made of these materials that react chemically to form sort of a rigid exterior. And it's a great idea because if you're little, it's a good way to build strength. It keeps you from getting crushed. You can make joints and then position your limbs more precisely and lift your body up off the ground. Great stuff, except for one thing, it doesn't stretch. So when insects and other arthropods want to get bigger, it's like if you your waist gets a little bigger and your belt doesn't close anymore, you need a new belt. So basically, or if you were to be living in medieval times and you outgrew your suit of armor, you'd have to go to the armorer and get a new suit of armor. So what insects do is basically grow a new flexible coat underneath the old one, a skin underneath the old one, and then use pressure to, they dissolve away everything they can except for the very hard exterior at each molt. And then once it's just down to that thin outer rigid membrane, they use pressure to split it open, and then they emerge fully formed with a flexible outer covering that actually takes a little while, from a few hours to a few days in some cases, to harden up again. So while this new coat is hardening up is when they can actually expand into a larger size. So it sort of packs in and expands during this very limited window of time before those chemical components react with each other to make it hard. And they have to do this repeatedly to get bigger. And arthropods are these jointed legged animals with external skeletons that don't have wings, like spiders and centipedes and ticks and chiggers, ticks and mites and the like, have the capacity to continue molting as adults. Lobsters, for example. Well, that's how you get these 60-pound lobsters and the like. They keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But once you have wings, if you're an insect, you can't molt your wings. And the reason you can't molt your wings is that you need living cells to grow that new external skeleton. And wings, to make wings lightweight, insects gave up that layer of living cells. So once you have wings, that's it. It's as big as you're going to get. You're not going to molt again. And so you can't get bigger. So that was question number one. Oh, and the process is entomologists call ecdysis, and it's from a Greek word, and it sounds like a reasonably obscure word, except there is one English word that borrows from that same Greek root, and that's ecdysiast, which is a stripper. That's a fancy word for a stripper. Now, I actually put this in one of my books called Bugs in the System to explain the process of, you know, removing one's outer garment, and my editor made me take it out, so...
Yeah,
I tell it to you here that an ecdysiast and ecdysis have some common connection. What's the honeybee situation? Not great. There's some great progress. What the listener is referring to is that honeybees, Apis mellifera, the western honeybee, which is actually not native to North America, it's been here a couple of hundred years, and Europeans brought them over. Are suffering enormously from a number of problems. And among the problems that are most plaguing these creatures are parasites. So just like Jonathan Swift wrote a couple of centuries ago, big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so on, infinitum. So even bugs have bugs that eat them. And in the case of honeybees, they're tiny little mites, like we talked about earlier, which are not real. They're not insects. They're arachnids, like we talked about earlier, eight legs when they're adults. And there are two types of mites. There's the varroa mite, sometimes called the vampire mite, which feeds on the blood or the hemolymph of the honeybee, particularly the male drones, the drones of the males, particularly when right before they become adult, and get in there, suck the blood when they're helpless and can't defend themselves, and colonies can crash because these numbers build up. The other mite is called a tracheal mite. The trachea is the respiratory tube of an insect, and they live in the respiratory tubes and make it difficult for the honeybees to breathe and generally reduce their vitality. And these two parasites have essentially wiped out wild colonies or unmanaged colonies of bees throughout much of North America. And there have been great strides in understanding the mechanisms with which honeybees can cope with mites. And there's some sort of population variation in how much they groom themselves and how they can keep themselves mite-free. There are some new insecticides in the market or miticides in the market, including menthol. So when you have a sore throat, what do you take? You take menthol, right? Well, menthol helps honeybee sore throats or their trachea. It makes it helps relieve them of tracheal mites. And there's some breeding studies going on in Minnesota. But around every corner, there's another threat. There are new pest species that keep showing up in honeybee colonies. There's a small hive beetle that's come over from Africa that gets into the honeybee nests and basically they have a sweet tooth and they get into the stored honey and foul it. They're kind of sloppy about how they eat, and then the honey ferments and the whole thing is a mess. So they're not great shape, but there's lots of people worried about them. Honeybees contribute something on the order of $10 billion to U.S. agriculture. So there's a lot of people worried about them. And the third question
was about mites. Essentially, was what do they eat? And it sounds like, well, it depends on what kind of mite you're talking about.
But just one general answer is they don't truly have sucking mouth parts. What they have are mouth parts, little mouth parts that they are, particularly on your skin, they will eject enzymes that break down tissues and turn the tissues into a soupy mess, and then sort of suck it back up, but not through a little tube. They just kind of lap it up, I guess, although they don't really have tongues either. And that's the general mechanism they use, whether they eat plants or whether they eat people's skin. They're not really blood-sucking per se. They're sort of dissolving your skin and sucking up whatever they can. That's a pleasant image for you. I hope this people aren't having lunch right now. So, and that generally the mechanism they use, no matter what they're eating. So, and they eat all kinds of things. Mites have an incredibly diverse diet. I mean, there's mites that eat dead animals. There's mites that eat living creatures. There's mites that live on other small creatures like insects. There's mites that eat plants.
And they're all pretty much specialized, though, one mite, a particular kind of thing it feeds on?
You would think, but remember, the clover mite feeds on just about any kind of low-lying herbaceous plant material. Mm-hmm. So there's one for there's an exception to every rule. I mean, there are mites that are extremely specialized that feed only, hummingbird mites. Hummingbird mites live in the nostrils of hummingbirds. That's about as specialized a locality as you could choose to live in. And there's a whole complex of species. There's different species associated with different hummingbirds. But then you got the clover mite that eats just about anything green that it can reach. So.
All right. Well, very good. Let's go on and talk with someone else. And that would be Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm enjoying your lecture immensely. And I want you to continue. I had only two questions, and one of them is from the perspective of the bug itself. You were mentioning something about this earlier, but do mosquitoes get ill when they're infected with malaria parasites? And my second question was just, tell me about daddy longlegs. I see them crawling around, and they're very happy, and I wonder, what do they do? Where do they come from? And okay. I have to hang up, so I'll
okay,
hang up.
Thanks. Thank you. Let's see. So daddy long legs, and then what was the first question? I just totally blanked out on this.
Take the daddy long legs, and I'll see if I can think of it. Because
okay.
It
was a great question. I remember thinking, I'm glad she asked me that question. But then I got distracted with the daddy long legs. Call back if you can. Daddy long legs are also not insects. And you can tell because they have eight legs, not six as adults, and they also don't have those three major body regions, head, thorax, and abdomen. They're arachnids like the spiders, but they're not spiders either. Their two body regions, cephalothorax and abdomen, are not joined at a waist-like constriction like spiders have. That's why they look like they're just one round little disc. And they have eight legs. And they are long, and they're kind of a subject of some controversy, I guess, or misconceptions. There's some urban legend or general myth that the most venomous creature in the world is a daddy long legs, except its fangs are too weak to break your skin. Well, this is simply not true. Daddy long legs, for the most part, eat dead things, and you don't need venom or fangs to tackle dead stuff. There are poisonous daddy long legs, but not because they inject venom. It's because they have glands that ooze onto the surface of their body various sorts of noxious chemicals, including cyanide. There's a group of daddy long legs that can produce cyanide. And then there's some daddy long legs that make substances that are that act on the nervous system in the same manner that the tranquilizer drug called Quaaludes act. So they're basically structurally related to Quaaludes. So very effective defense. If some spider grabs them, then the spider gets so mellow it kind of doesn't bother finishing up the meal, and the daddy long legs can move away. They can't regrow new legs until a new molt. So this is another thing. People seem to like to yank their legs off and walk away feeling, no harm done. But actually, it puts them at a singular disadvantage until the next molt. And if they're adults, once they molt and reproduce sexually, they don't get bigger. They're a mysterious bunch. They're not very numerous in terms of species. They are, and I don't know if this is appropriate for the air, There are fossil daddy long legs, and they are among the oldest land arthropod fossils. So these are jointed legged animals that one of the nice things about that exoskeleton is it let creatures, you know, crawl up out of the primeval mire and colonize terrestrial environments. And one way that they knew that these ancient daddy long legs were land dwelling, not only do contemporary long legs live on land, but because fossilized in these remains that were over 300 million years old is what, for want of a better word, we can call an intromittent organ, a male organ that is used for the transfer of sperm. Aquatic arthropods and other animals don't need such a device because sperm can live in water. So once you get that organ, you're all set for life on land. Now, I don't know if the FCC is going to complain about this show. It's all in the interest of science here.
And education. It's an educational program. Now, fortunately, one person was paying attention to the caller, and that was Henry Frayne, our director. And the question was, oh, no, he said it was a caller who called in.
Thank you,
maybe
caller.
It was the caller called back. The question was, for mosquitoes that carry the parasite that causes malaria,
right.
Is the mosquito affected by, do mosquitoes get malaria?
That was such a good question, and I am glad you asked because that's a subject of intense research at the moment because there are many different species of mosquitoes. Not all of them can actually act as vectors of malaria or carriers of malaria. The chief malaria vector for humans, the species that most affects is responsible for infecting humans with the pathogen that causes malaria is called Anopheles gambiae, and it's the malaria mosquito of Africa. And recently, the genome of Anopheles gambiae was completely sequenced, so every gene is now known and of this particular species. And what investigators are interested in is they're trying to determine which genes influence the ability of this insect to act as a vector and to withstand carrying this pathogen around. And the goal of some of this research is to engineer mosquitoes that are incapable of acting as vectors or carriers, and the hope that they will outperform the ones that are vectors, because there is a penalty, in at least in some strains of some mosquitoes, to carrying around this parasite. So it doesn't make them die. It's not necessarily lethal. If it were lethal, that wouldn't be good for the pathogen. But there is apparently a cost to the mosquito of carrying this microorganism around. So the hope is that someday there will be, if science can develop the technology and if the non-target risks are determined to be low enough, mosquitoes that are genetically engineered to be incapable of transmitting malaria that will outcompete the natural mosquitoes that do act as vectors. So that's one angle on mosquito control. It's a really good question. So I can't imagine why I couldn't remember it for 5 minutes.
Well, and we also had someone who was listening to our bee conversation and who called in and wanted to suggest a book. And so here, what I was doing was I was on my computer here looking up the book. And I don't know if this is a book that you're familiar with. It's relatively new, came out this spring. The title of the book is Robbing the Bees.
Yes.
You know this book?
Uh-huh.
Okay. By Holly Bishop. And the subtitle is A Biography of Honey, the Sweet Liquid Gold That Seduced the World. And apparently it was first published in the spring, in March. And the publisher of the book is Free Press. So you know this book?
Yeah, I recommend it highly. You know, my recommendation perhaps doesn't carry a lot of weight because I read just about anything with any insect reference in it. So, I mean, I even read an entire book about silkworm missiles just because they were called silkworm missiles. So by Iris Chang.
By Iris Chang, yeah. Uh-huh.
But it's only because they were called silkworm missiles. So the fact that I enjoyed it may not necessarily be a general indication, but I thought I really did enjoy reading it.
All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left here with May Barenbaum. She's an entomologist. She's a scientist who studies insects and occasionally on the program, and that's what we talk about. You have questions about them, not extermination questions, but more general kinds of questions. You can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of other people here, and we'll go to a caller in Paris, line number 4. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Listen, I have a question about, I was hiking in the Hoosier National Forest in the rain, and the rain was coming down pretty good. But some of the trees, and not always the same species, there was foam coming down on the tree, almost like somebody was washing dishes up in the tree somewhere. And some was more and some was less. And I've always wondered, and nobody can answer, where the foam came from.
Was this, what time of year was this?
Probably spring.
Ah, good. I'm glad.
It's so long ago that I can't remember. It's either spring or fall.
Spring would make more sense.
Okay, let's say spring.
What you were likely seeing is the immature stage of a bug that's appropriately called the spittle bug. Spittle bugs are...
The bugs themselves were coming down in the foam?
No, the bugs are immersed in the foam, and it's a... these are sap-sucking true bugs,
uh-huh.
and in the immature stage, they're sort of green, generally green, soft-bodied creatures that plug their mouth parts into the vascular system of the plants and then just start pumping fluids through themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the trouble, there are two types of vascular fluids in plants, two types of plant blood, if you will. There's the so-called phloem, and phloem is the stuff that carries sugars from the leaves.
How do you spell that, phloem?
P-H-L-O-E-M. And this is this is what takes the, you know, the photosynthetic machinery in the leaves makes sugars, and this the phloem carries the sugars to the rest of the plant. The
mm-hmm.
The other fluid comes from the roots and carries water and a few minerals and the like up from the ground to the photosynthetic machinery in the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Spittle bugs eat xylem. That's X-Y-L-E-M. That's the stuff that is very watery, doesn't have much nutrient in it, just sort of minerals and the like. So for these spittle bugs to get enough to eat, they have to pump huge quantities of the fluids through to extract the little bit of sugar and a little bit of protein that's in there.
Yeah,
so 300 to 400 times their own body weight in fluids they process in a day. And it comes out the other end. Now, instead of just wasting it, what they do is inject a material into the excrement, into the watery excrement that makes it foamy. So that has the end result of having them surrounded by this sticky mass of what looks like what you're not allowed to do in the New York City subways. You know, just they look like spittle. And it's really hard for ants, which are a big problem for any soft-bodied creature feeding on plants, to get through that. They don't like to get their antennae all crudded up. So they'll sort of tentatively approach the spittle and then start grooming and leave the spittle bug alone. So it's they're typically common in early spring.
Do they exclude the ants? Do they make the ants leave that tree?
I'm not sure. Ants kind of call the shots, but they may not leave the tree, but they tend not to pursue spittle bugs as food. So not many things can get through that massive gook.
Okay, but you have answered a question that I've been wondering about for several years now.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you.
And I've taken notes.
Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Well, do at least one more caller here. This is someone who is listening in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have found some sound recordings for other creatures. I found a birdsong sound recording guide, which is really good, and I found one on calls of Ohio frogs and toads. And I'm wondering if there is a comparable CD available for insects, night calls of insects, because I'm just really enjoying all the night sounds and even the day sounds, and I can't tell which one is which, or if I'm even listening to a frog versus an insect. Do you know if such a thing exists?
There are CDs, but there's also a superb website called Singing Insects of North America. It's run out of, I believe, University of Florida. And if you just type in, you know, quote, Singing Insects of North America, it's a phenomenal site. It has complete life history of every insect. It has sort of a sonogram of the call, you know, a visual depiction of the call. And you click on a file, a sound file, and you can hear exactly what the different species sound like. And there are cicadas up there. There are grasshoppers. There are just about anything you can think of that sings, crickets. It's just a phenomenal sight. In terms of CDs, the Insectarium of Montreal has one available, and I believe the there is a North American, I think, I'm trying to remember who puts it out, but there are a couple of CDs of singing insects. But frankly, when I want to figure out what I'm listening to, I go to that website. It's just terrific.
Great. I don't know if you have time, but I'm wondering, there's been an awful lot of stuff in the newspaper about people questioning evolution, and I'm wondering if you have any time left to talk about insect evidence for evolution. Thanks.
Well, let me ask David if we have time.
Unfortunately, we do. Well, truly, I'm not sure that we really do, because we're kind of coming down to the end here.
That would be another good hour, frankly.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking, that it would be the kind of thing that you could probably spend actually a lot of time.
And I'd be happy to. About. And insects, you know, provide lots and lots of illustrations. So, but very hard to pack into the next 30 seconds. So.
Well, maybe at another day we can do that. And I'm sure that on another day, May will come back.
Happy
to. Talk with us some more. In the meantime, if you're interested in insects, you can head out to the bookstore or the library and look for some of her books, including Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs, a collection of her columns, Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. And those were pretty much all pieces that were written for a particular publication
three quarters of them. There's about 25% of them are new for the book. So
okay, and so that, and then there are the two that are published by the U of I Press: 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, and 99 more Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. And those are being in the bookstore too. And those, one of the things I always say about those books is, if you have kids who are interested in insects, that would be a great thing to kind of get them started, because it's full of May's own unique brand of humor, and they're a lot of fun. So if you're interested in bugs, that'd be one place that you can go. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
May Barenbaum is head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Every once in a while, she's here. We talk about insects. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. We're going to take a break, and then we'll have news and more Focus 580. First, though, an update on the markets.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Wheat, corn, and soybeans lower on the Chicago Board of Trade in early trading today, as